Dave, welcome to the Canadian Canoe Podcast.
Kyle, thanks for having me in.
Cheers.
It's a pleasure. We've been trying to do this for quite a while now.
I was thinking on the drive over, finally pinned him down.
Yeah, you finally got me. Finally.
Man, you got out of the Northwest Territories just in time.
We did.
When did you fly out of Baker Lake?
Would have been August 18th, I believe. August 19th, we flew out of Baker Lake.
And Ellen and I got evacuated when? On the 19th? I think on the 19th.
It was about the same time. It was about exactly the same time.
What was the...
Yeah.
What was the vibe in Baker Lake? Was it impacted by the fires?
No. It's a whole different world out there. They're self-sufficient. Part of none of it. They're all on their own out there.
Yeah.
I will say, though, super cool town.
Yeah, I've never been.
Very friendly people. Super cool town. We just happened to get there the same day as their high school graduation was happening.
Oh, cool.
So they're having these big parties in the school gym. We could go in and play, watch them do their traditional games and do all that and hang out with the locals and see some of the traditional wear and, I don't know, just play some games. It was sweet.
Cool. It always amazes me that it's so far inland, but not big ships come in there, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, it's none of it's only inland community.
Inland port community, you mean. Or only inland community
at all.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. They're like a maritime people.
Yeah.
You're right. Every community is on the Arctic Ocean.
Makes sense too, right? Because they're all Inuit.
Yeah.
And they are
seals and whales.
Ocean going people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. They're
very different from the Dene inland.
Yeah. So I guess your trip started in Dene territory.
Very much so.
I know what your trip was, but. Fill in the listener on what you just did.
So my paddling partner, Chris Giard, and I paddled 1,625 kilometers from Yellowknife to Baker Lake. Yeah.
Over 6 weeks.
Yeah. And the name of the trip was Akilinik.
Yeah.
Which is an Inuit word for, there's a couple different translations, but it means the water on the other side of land.
Okay.
Or on the other side of land. So in our case, it was referring to the Thelon River being the water on the other side of the land, which was on the other side of Great Slave Lake.
The big bite of land portage, you mean?
Yeah.
Right. And you did something a bit different, or maybe unusual is the wrong word, because the route you followed, most people would go for Pike's Portage.
That's right. Most people would. Most people would go Pike's Portage north through Artillery Lake into, I think it's Partridge Creek, up into the Hanbury, Sifton Lake. And that's all fine and good. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But where the Hanbury comes down into the Thelon, close to the Clark River Junction in the middle of Thelon, you miss a couple hundred kilometers of the Thelon River. It really hits it right in the middle kind of thing. So we really wanted to get in to Whitefish Lake and see the headwaters and then paddle the Thelon in full.
Right. So how'd you do that?
In order to do that, we crossed Great Slave Lake and we went from the north shore to the south shore and paddled right through the community of Lutzelke.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then followed a traditional route that a previous guest you had on here, Seth Wooten, had paddled it, and he'd given us a lot of good information on it. We paddled through Stark Lake and to Chitwa, Mid Lake, into Meridian Lake.
Yeah.
So it's an old traditional route that kind of, it's pretty rough in there, not going to lie. It's not it's not like I would highly recommend that route. if you're trying to get to Pike's Portage or something, you may as well just follow the North Shore. It's not any easier to go the way we did.
No, and as a guy who's never done Pike's, it was a slog.
Yeah.
I just can imagine trying to do it, but overgrown.
Yeah, but totally overgrown. So the portage we used from the Meridian Lake up into the Snowdrift system was 4 kilometers.
Okay.
A lot of uphill. Probably.
You gained about 1,000 feet.
About 1,000 feet. Yeah. About 300-400 meters of uphill.
Yeah.
And we started off on the satellite imagery before I left. I found a winter road. And the locals in Lutzelke told us about this winter road or travel route.
Right.
And we could see it on the satellite imagery coming out of Meridian Lake. And we managed to find it. And it was really good for the first 800 meters. And then it vanished.
Right.
It just disappeared altogether.
Just overgrown.
Overgrown. I don't realistically know the last time somebody had.
Yeah, you got to be careful with those satellite photos because they could be 10 years old. Pretty misleading. Misleading.
But a couple groups had been through that portage previously. I know Frank Wolf had done it back in 2006 or 7, and he made a documentary, the Mammalian documentary.
Okay.
Showcases that kind of route. And another guy we found, John McGinnis.
I've heard that name. I've heard Frank's name too. But.
And John McGinnis had come the opposite direction. And other people had done it as well. I mean, right. It's not unheard of. But
right.
And we did see signs of people through this portage from Meridian. Over, it's called the McDonald Fault Portage, if you had to give it a name.
Right.
We found blazes on the trees. I found an empty can of ginger ale.
Really?
Like literally in the middle of nowhere. It was very surprising.
It's wild, eh? How we've managed to get our hands on every corner of the earth, man.
It wasn't that old of a can. Like, it had normal tabs on it. And it didn't look like it had been there. Maybe it had been there 15 years. I have no idea. There's no way of knowing. But, like, somebody had been up there and drank a can of ginger ale and left it.
Have you seen, or it got thrown out of a plane window? have you seen the movie? I forget the name of the movie where the whole premise is some. I want to say like South African tribe has like had no human contact, but then a pilot flies over and throws a Pepsi bottle like, out the window, and then some kid finds the Pepsi bottle or Coke bottle, and then the whole community, like, I forget, it's a comedy. Like, okay. This Pepsi bottle becomes like this like sacred.
The deity?
The community. It's a hilarious movie. I forget what it's called. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
Cool, man. So good trip.
It was a fantastic trip. It was really cool. It was really fun.
Yeah, and this was kind of...
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun.
And this was kind of part two for you because you had, two summers prior paddled from...
Yeah, 2018, Chris and I, again, we paddled from the Yukon Northwest Territories border.
Yeah.
On the North Kennel Road.
Right, down the Keel.
Down the Teeshoe and the Keel, the Mackenzie, then up the Great Bear River and across the southern shore of Great Bear Lake into the Eta Trail.
Right.
And we ran out of time, so we flew out of Gamedy.
Right, trying to get to Yellowknife, though.
Trying to get to Yellowknife, yeah.
So, but for that little stretch between Gamedy and Yellowknife, you've now paddled from the Yukon to almost Hudson Bay.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yep. Cool.
Yeah.
How'd you get into doing, like, of all the... You know, I know a few people who do big trips every summer, but you're right, you know, you're right there in the upper echelons, man, of people dedicating their summers to going on these huge trips every year. Like, how'd you get into it?
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we're the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Kyle, it's like a certain level of this, like, congratulatory comments from people make me really, really uncomfortable. Because, like, before the trip, you kind of have to sell it a bit to try to drum up some, like, sponsorship or funding or help.
Right.
With some gear, some cash.
Yeah, because you were Royal Canadian Geographic sponsor.
It was, yeah. Right. That's right, yeah. So you got to sell the trip a bit. And then you go out and do it. And then afterwards, you have to sell the trip a little bit to help support the people who supported you to go do the trip.
Sure.
But, like, the reality is it's just something that Chris and I like to do. It's just, like, for fun. It's like, you know, some people want to go golfing and want to hit two rounds in a day. It's just, like, a fun thing.
Right. The secret is you're going either, no matter what.
We were going no matter what. That's the secret. Yeah. Right. And just kind of grew... over time again, and there's like a certain amount of like paddler's amnesia that happens because like it's not all fun.
No,
it's a significant amount of work.
Yes,
it's actually really hard a lot of the time, but you don't remember those things. Like,
no,
even it's been like 2 weeks now. I don't know.
Yeah, you'll be a few months from now, you'll be itching for the next one.
Yeah, you kind of like forget about all the really hard parts.
Yeah.
But it's like, I don't know, I work as a teacher to pay the bills, and like we call it scaffolded learning. So you start just on the weekends with your buddies and making all the mistakes in the backwoods of wherever you're from. And,
yeah.
And you grow from there, and you do like a week-long trip, and then a 3-week trip, then a month-long trip. And then like, okay, well, I did that. We can do something else now. And you just kind of learn and grow from there, and then it just all starts to escalate.
Yeah. Yeah, and you've done, like, you've covered a lot of ground, man, because you've done this, you know, Yukon to Hudson, almost Hudson Bay, but then you've done a few trips in Labrador, too.
Yeah, I've done a few trips in Labrador, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, did a big canoe trip there. Has Noah been on the program yet?
Noah's the only guest who's been on twice.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm going to have him on a third time.
Yeah, again, Chris Jared, the guy I did these two trips with, was on with Noah and Alex Trainer and I, and we paddled across Labrador.
Yeah, you're like you're the original Northern Scavenger, like guest paddlers.
Right, I'll be 39 in a couple of weeks, so it's like, I don't know, it's kind of like 39, I don't have any kids.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't imagine in my wildest dreams when I was 25 that in 15 years I would still have the time and ability to go do these trips. It's just almost just like happenstance of life, and I have the ability and the summer's off, and and now the ability to plan these trips and the confidence in myself to be able to plan them and execute them,
right,
that it just keeps growing and scale and difficulty and
the luxury of, you know, summer's off as a teacher is a luxury, isn't it?
Huge.
It's like huge. Pretty hard for your average guy to get, this trip was what, 6 weeks?
6 weeks. To take
42 days off work to go.
Yeah, right?
And even if you could scrape together that much time off, it would basically mean you have to work every day for the rest. Like, you can't take any other time off. And that's like a tough sell to your wife or your kids or your friends even, you know?
There's that saying, time or money.
Yeah.
And who has both? Old retired people.
Right. Who can't?
Which is not us.
Who can't go over the McDonald's portage.
No, that's right. That's right. So I had another friend ask why. Like, why do I want to do it in this style? So we averaged 39 kilometers a day for 42 days.
Man, that's booting it.
We're booting it, right? And, like, we're young, we're strong, and we can. Like, that's basically it. Like, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I've given a lot of thought to this over the years. Say, 2 years ago, there's, like, a controversial statement by a guy named... Actually, he's also been on the program, Bob Henderson.
Yeah, he was on the show.
Yeah, he came out, I think it was at the Wilderness Canoe Symposium a couple of years ago, and kind of tore into people who, you know, like the Frank Wolfs of the world, who go out and average 39 kilometers a day for 42 days. And he's like, why don't these people, like, slow down and enjoy where they are, this kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
Which I totally understand. It's a totally valid statement. But I think if the two people... or the people going on the trip all have the same intention going into it, I don't see anything wrong with it. Like, there's a traditional way of doing things that used to happen in the past, but like, you know, we're strong, young, and capable.
Yeah.
We had the intention. We wanted to travel through the land as efficiently, quickly as we could.
It also wouldn't be possible. Like, it would be possible, but you wouldn't be able to get from Yellowknife to Baker Lake in 6 weeks.
No.
Or like, you have to move that fast to do it in 6 weeks. If you were moving slower, you would have then had to have higher expensive float planes. Yeah. Like, there's a reality in the north that, like, if you want to do it without float planes, you have to cover huge distances to link these routes together.
Yes.
Like, I also get what Bob's saying.
Yeah.
But sometimes it doesn't work. Like, if you want to paddle from Yellowknife to Baker Lake and you want to do it in the summer, the seasons are not long up there, and you got to haul ass.
That's right.
Or you got to get flowing into the upper Thelon somewhere.
Yeah.
For $5,000 or $6,000.
Right.
And then you can take your time and, like, just putter along down the river.
Yeah.
But
you're not going from Yellowknife to Baker Lake.
But you're not going, and you've just spent $6,000, which you guys did this whole thing with no bush plane.
No, we did this whole thing for like... probably about $7,000.
Including flights from Nova Scotia.
Including flights return to Nova
that's
Scotia
cheap,
for
man.
Two people.
That's
cheap. It's
cheap. You know, like, if you take the airfare out of it, like, if you basically did it for, what,
three?
The cost of food.
Cost of food.
And
The canoe.
And the canoe. Seth's canoe. You went in Seth's canoe.
That's right. And we went in Seth's canoe. There's a lot of connections here. So we've had Noah, Seth, Bob.
Yeah.
All on this program.
That was a hoot. I guess...
The world of wilderness canoe tripping in Canada really is pretty small. We all pretty much know each other now.
The canoe trade was pretty funny.
I've forgotten about that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess no, this is an inside story because we should tell the listeners, but... You set off from my backyard in Yellowknife.
Yep, absolutely. And if anyone out there is listening and they're planning a trip out of Yellowknife, Kyle's a fantastic host. He's got a great little bunkie right next to the water that's perfect for organizing your gear and sleeping in beforehand. And you literally push off from his backyard right onto the Great Slave Lake. It's an ideal situation.
If anyone wants to contact me, they're more than welcome to.
But we were there.
Yeah, and Seth
kind of the night before we were leaving, and we're under the gun to, like, you know, get everything ready. And the last thing we had to do was get the rivets and the webbing into the canoe with, like, the knee pads and, like, outfit the canoe, basically, which would have taken a couple hours. And a mutual friend of ours, Seth, shows up with, just by happenstance, with an outfitted canoe on his van.
Basic.
Yeah. And he takes one look at our 17-foot Novacraft Roilex Prospector. He's like, that's a pretty nice boat. Like, I like that boat. And then, I don't even know. It just...
Who proposed the trade? I can't remember who first.
He did it first.
Did he?
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, saved you a whole evening's worth of work.
Yeah. Just on a handshake. And we just...
It's awesome.
We literally just traded boats on a handshake.
Man,
on the spot.
Did you hear about his ordeal this summer?
I briefly, yeah.
I'm going to have him on, or I want to. I haven't actually asked him, but I'm going to try to get him on to actually have him explain the ordeal. But
this, he's paddled a lot of kilometers across the country.
That's when he called me and said I need, like, to get evacuated out of here. That's when I knew it was serious, because this isn't like a guy who is unprepared and doesn't know what he's doing. Like, yeah. This is a guy who's paddled across Canada. Like, literally, I forget where he started, but, like, somewhere.
Montreal.
Yeah. Montreal to Inuvik. Like, literally across Canada, most of it up river. You know, like, he's the type of guy that when he says he needs out, you're like, oh yeah, he probably needs out.
Yeah.
I guess for those listening, he's from Yellowknife like I am, and there was a full evacuation of Yellowknife due to wildfire, and that all happened at the same time that Seth was trying to get picked up as a result of a pretty serious eye infection. So then it just complicated everything, and yeah, I want to have him on the show, but
yeah,
man, he got himself into a real situation this summer. Holy smokes.
Yeah, a real pickle out there.
Yeah.
But down that western shore, Great Slave Lake, I don't know if you're bored at home, all you people listening, like, pull it up on the maps. Like, it's a pretty obscure part of the territories.
And no one ever goes there. And that typically means I've learned that typically means that it's because it's not worth going to, or it's really difficult to access.
There's a reason.
Yeah. He told me he wouldn't wish it on his worst enemy.
Wow.
So I'm curious to get the full debrief, and hopefully we do it on the podcast. And
wow.
Yeah, so I won't ruin the story. You guys have any close calls? Or was it pretty smooth sailing?
No, it was pretty smooth sailing. It's kind of boring to say, but, like, nothing broke. Nobody got hurt. Hardly used the first aid kit, which is great, really.
Yeah.
Sewed her pants a couple of times, but, like, no, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
There's a couple of rapids at the top of the Thelon that were, like, we scouted from shore, and we're like, oh yeah, no problem. And then we got down into it, and the waves were massive.
Right.
Breaking, like, over our heads. And
really? Yeah, thankful.
It was a bit of an eye-opener.
You were thankful for the spray deck then?
Big time.
Did you? Yeah. But you didn't swamp the thing?
No, nothing like that.
Who was in the back? Who was in the front? Or you switched?
We swapped every day. So it's just luck of the draw and what rapids you get to run in the stern.
Yeah.
And Chris was in the stern for all five rapids that day. Yeah, he did good. He did really good. Yeah, no problems there.
He's from the States, eh?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, he's from Massachusetts.
Cool.
Young Christopher.
He's a young guy.
Yeah, 27.
Just a whippersnapper, man.
Yeah. He's a...
He's done a lot of miles for a 27-year-old. Holy smokes.
Yeah. He's a... What would you call him? A serial job quitter. Right. Yeah. He just quits jobs so he can go on long trips. And he has no real possessions like a couch or a car.
Doesn't he like make his own clothes and stuff?
Yeah, he's pretty... He was born in the wrong century for sure. Right. Yeah. Wool pants, wool hat.
Head by a century, man.
Yeah. And like close calls, we had like a really interesting, we had some interesting wildlife encounters. So at the top of the Snowdrift River is Sandy Lake.
Yeah.
Really fascinating place. It's right in like the heart of like Esker country.
Right.
Up there. So Sandy Lake, aptly named. The whole Snowdrift River realistically could be renamed the Sandrift River.
Right.
So it's just filled with sand. It was remarkable. But so we got up to the top of the river and we had a really great tailwind, which was pretty rare for us.
Mm-hmm.
And the lake was about 25 kilometers long. So we sailed down the lake, cruised down the lake, pretty pumped about that. And as we were getting close to the east end of the lake, we saw a grizzly bear come walking down the shore.
Okay.
And like where we were, like the lake's not very wide. It's like maybe 400 meters wide kind of thing.
Yeah, that's
with these great big like eskers that kind of like cross the lake. So like
right.
It was really quite shallow where we were.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really like realize it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
This grizzly bear kind of like circled around us a bit and started coming out, started like swimming out towards us. And
oh shit.
Chris was in the bow and he turns around and he looks at me and he's like, how fast do bears swim? And I look down in the water and it's like 2 feet deep. And I was like, he doesn't have to swim. Like he's just going to walk here. Like,
oh God.
And I was like taking pictures and like, okay, shit. I think we got to go. So it wasn't really like, it was interesting, but like, you know, we banged the gunnels and yelled a few times and it stopped.
Yeah.
And went back to shore. But like it didn't run away. It's kind of like sat there, stood on its hind legs, sniffed around.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then as we started to paddle away, it just got shallower and shallower. We actually had to get out of the boat.
Yeah, that would be a terrifying situation if you grounded and then...
Yeah.
You know, so that happens. And sometimes you got to, like, push the fucking canoe for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of yards. Yeah,
exactly. And we actually had to work our way towards the bear to find deeper water. Yeah, it was really unnerving.
That's unnerving.
But it made me think... So then we had to camp really close to there, too. We camped on the north shore.
Right.
But it doesn't really, like, mean anything, right?
No.
Bears can swim. It's fine. But, like, there's tracks of grizzly bears everywhere, and, like...
Yeah.
We had to camp there. We didn't have much of a choice, so...
And you didn't take a firearm?
We did not have a firearm, no. So we just, you know, playing smart with where we put our food and where we cooked and where we put up the tent.
Yeah.
We just went to bed. But I can only assume that the bear came and visited in the night. But I have no way of knowing. No way of knowing. But then the next morning, we leave our campsite, and our first portage is about 500 meters down the lake.
Yeah.
We get there and I get out of the boat and I turn around and I look across the bay from us and there's two cubs on the beach.
Oh.
Yeah. And the same bear comes up over the ridge. It was a mama bear. It was a sow with two cubs.
Wow.
And I was thinking like, well, maybe that's why she was like,
yeah,
coming at us the way she was, or maybe this is like a hunting technique she had, like,
right.
Maybe waiting for a caribou to come out into the shallow water and just ambushing it there. Or like,
yeah.
I don't know. The whole thing was pretty unnerving, but like at the same time, it's like, what do we do? Like, what do you do?
It's a little unnerving that it's such shallow water.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like that would make me a little queasy, man.
And like no fear. She didn't have any fear.
No. But that was like the lesson learned on our wolf encounter last year.
Yeah.
Is it went from being like, oh, there's a wolf, like let's get out the cameras and take some pictures of it, you know, and like had the telephoto out and binoculars, and like it just went from this like pleasant wolf encounter to, oh, this wolf is charging us
very quickly
in like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And it like it just flips like that, you know. You hardly have time to realize what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, at first it's like, you know, a few hundred yards off and we're kind of like, that's kind of neat. It just keeps coming and coming and coming.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, next thing you know, it's like 15 yards away.
Right.
And until this, I don't know what it would have done. That, like,
yeah.
If we hadn't fired the bear banger, like.
I think it was inquisitive. We had a close wolf.
It was inquisitive. It freaked us out. It freaked us out, but there was four of us and one wolf.
Yeah.
If anyone wants to see this, it's like on the episode 2 or 3 of the Northern Scavenger thing from last year. But it, like, it's not, obviously. It's
very smart animals.
Smart animal, and it's like not, you know, it can't. One wolf is no match for four paddlers.
No.
So like, what? I don't know what its intentions were. I think it was just inquisitive, but it got way too close for comfort.
Yeah.
You know, I had my shotgun like pointed at it, like literally ready to pull the trigger, and then Graham fired off a bear banger.
Yeah.
And that caused it to run off, but it was like a bit unnerving.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Big animal, right?
Big animal, and it was at most 30 feet.
Wow.
You know, and not stopping, like
yeah.
coming straight at us.
Yeah.
Pretty quick.
Yeah.
So anyway, I can see how you like you could go from taking pictures of a grizzly
yeah.
to
yeah.
being like, oh fuck, that grizzly's a little close. You
know? Yeah.
So
one day we were coming up the Snowdrift River, paddling up it. So we were on the outside of a bend, but there's a really high sand bank to our left, but we're traveling as close to the bank as we possibly could to stay out of the main current, like
sure.
eddy hopping your way up,
yeah.
sneaking your way up. And we chased two pups out of a den that was at the top of this sand bank.
Cool.
Yeah. Super cool. So we nosed the canoe in like right underneath. I guess we weren't really thinking, but we just nosed the canoe in right underneath the den on the bank. And we could hear the wolves howling behind the bank.
Wow.
So I turned back to Chris. I was in the bow. And I say, Chris, how's your wolf howl? He's like, And then so he, oh, so he lets out a howl. And I turn around and I look in front of me. And there's a white wolf running down the bank directly at me. And I had only had enough time to put my paddle
and
on the bank
off.
And push off and say, nope. And that was it. And it was there. It was like from me to you. Like I could have reached out and touched it with my paddle.
That's
like,
crazy.
And like I was in the bow of the canoe, so I'm like I'm really small already, and it's on a bank, and right, and it's 130-pound dog, like
yeah.
massive.
Yeah, probably.
I think she wasn't growling, but like
right.
she was coming at us, like
yeah,
yeah.
Wow.
But we stayed there for like an hour. Just we went
just
to the other
them.
Side of the river and just hung out and
cool.
Really cool. The pups
yeah,
came back.
They're cool like, animals, man.
She turned into like a dog. Like
yeah.
she howled for a while. Hackles were up, but then like she relaxed and tail went down. She laid down. She just, like, licked her paws. Like,
yeah, they're cool.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate. You know, the government of the Northwest Territories is shooting them from helicopters.
Still.
Well, I don't know if they did it in 2023, but in 2022 they did it.
Really?
It's just... I mean, I know why they do it. It's to preserve the caribou. They think it's to,
yeah,
to promote the growth of the caribou herds, which are in rough shape. But
right,
I don't know, man. Just something about that doesn't sit well with me. Just some guy,
yeah,
gunning them down out of a helicopter window. You know, they're yeah. so cool when you see them up and close like that. They're
remarkable.
They're so cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, I know it's a loaded question.
It's a loaded, and it's very controversial.
And
it's a long history of it, too.
A long
the poisoning
history.
They used to do, and the,
yeah.
Yeah, the traditional trappers that used to live up there on the land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see any caribou?
We did. Not as many as we would have hoped. But
yeah, well, that's yeah. a problem. There's not many left.
We had one campsite on our first day on Aberdeen Lake where it was like a caribou highway, and just behind our camp. There's like one or two.
Yeah.
But there's like a steady stream all night and all morning.
Yeah, they're not really scared of people, eh?
No.
On our trip, they came right up to us. Graham and I were portaging, and they just walked right up to us. Like,
yeah.
It's just, they're so friendly, man.
Yeah. But the moose would run away. Yeah, but the caribou wouldn't.
Yeah.
They just I don't know what's up with the caribou.
Yeah. Did you,
the muskox wouldn't run away either. We saw
tons no, of yeah, they just kind of all hang out, and they know that nothing's coming for them.
Yeah, up on the barren lands, from the research I did, muskox are the only animal you should actually run away from. Everything else, you need to stay on your ground, including the grizzly bears.
Right, but the muskox, because if they charge, it's hopeless.
Yeah, it's hopeless.
Right.
They'd run through brick walls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got a muskox tag for this fall, and I'm a little nervous to shoot it, man.
Because you want to get it.
Well, you want to drop it.
You want to drop it. Because
if you don't drop it, it's
yeah.
going to... What do you think it's going to do? It's either going to run away or it's going to stare at you and run at you. And like...
Yeah.
It's a big animal coming at you, man.
Well, it's deceivingly large because they're only like 4 feet tall, but like 1,000 pounds.
Yeah, 1,000 pounds. I've been told that I can expect, if I shoot a decent male, 800 pounds of meat.
Holy smokes.
Once I like butcher the thing.
Yeah.
It's insane.
That's insane.
It's insane.
But then, and then you would have a muskox robe.
I guess so.
Maybe.
Yeah, I'm not going to throw the pelt away.
No, God, no.
No, no. Of course
no.
not. Rug, robe. I don't know. Really good floor for my wall tent, maybe.
Yes.
I think that could be cool.
Yeah, I'm sure Bo, your baby boy, can just be wrapped up in it in the coldest temperatures of the winter.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. So, anyway, it's back to guests of the show. I'm going to go to Oliver Duray. First ever guest of the podcast. I'm going to go to his cabin and see if I can get a muskox this winter. So
it'd be cool.
Yeah, yeah. But I am a bit scared to... You want to make sure you shoot it in the right spot.
It's like the shoulder, right?
Or the lungs, like through the lungs or the heart. Yeah, you don't want to like hit it in like the calf or something, or like the leg, you know? Like,
yeah.
And then you're just going to piss it off.
Right.
And there's all these rules. You have to like, you have to have a big gun. You can't shoot a muskox unless you're using a big gun.
Okay.
It's like in the hunting regulations. Okay. Because for this reason, they want you to kill that thing. You know,
yeah.
They don't want the animal to suffer, but I think it's also a safety thing. Like,
right.
If you just piss it off, it's not going to be a good situation.
Right. But that's cool that you got the tag to go do it. It's an amazing recovery story there of the muskox.
You saw a ton of them, eh?
Tons of them. Literally hundreds of them. Hundreds of them.
Yeah.
Probably 200 of them.
The population's made a huge recovery.
It's remarkable. Their numbers back in the 20s or 30s.
Yeah. And now there's all these basically extinct almost. Yeah. And now there's all these programs to get people to be hunting them instead of caribou, because the caribou population's down, but the muskox population is, as you say, real healthy.
Yeah.
There's
this is a thing about the Barrenlands that nobody had like told me, but people probably don't really talk about much because you don't realize it, but like most of the time the Barrenlands were empty. Like it was empty of like visible large mammal life.
Mm-hmm.
Like lush in life and like berries and plants and whatnot and like fish in the lakes and the rivers, but like as far as animals go, it was like void most of the time.
Right.
But you could tell that there was tons of big animals around by like how many bones you would see.
Yeah.
There's literally bones
everywhere.
Everywhere you go, there's signs of death. And through that you see that there is life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to
There's the bones phrase it. Literally everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. And it's like, you can kind of see them. You know, in the forest, there's probably also bones everywhere, but you can't see them because there's forest between you and them.
Yeah, and then like the decomposition of things up there is so slow and takes so long.
Yes.
Like our whole idea, like, I understand, like, time is a construct of man. But like, the time's almost irrelevant up there because like, there's a bone laying on the ground.
Right.
Maybe it's been there 300 years.
Right.
Who knows?
Right.
But that's why there's so many bones laying everywhere. Just because
it takes forever for things. Their things are frozen. They're in like a...
Yeah. There's like 6 weeks a year for something to like...
not be frozen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To biodegrade.
Right, right. Did you hear about the... were you familiar with the Soviet satellite that crashed up on your route?
I've heard these stories. I hear there's a good podcast on it.
There's a fantastic... I forget the name. There's a fantastic podcast. I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
It's a crazy story, man.
There's a lake that happened up by Warden's Grove in the middle
of
the...
Yeah, that's where it went down.
There's a lake up there now named Cosmo Lake.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. That's where it made landfall. But as it was like... coming through the Earth's atmosphere, it like went over Litzel K and probably right around where you were, like on the Snowdrift River there.
Yeah.
And it was, I didn't know this, they had nuclear satellites. It was powered by like a nuclear engine, and it was full of uranium or like plutonium or whatever they use.
Yeah.
And as it was entering the Earth's atmosphere, it was like shedding nuclear waste that then got littered all over.
Really?
Litzel K. Like, there's the podcast has these stories of like people doing like a roofing job. Yeah. I think in Fort Resolution, which is not that far from Litzel K.
Okay, yeah.
And like the guy finding like a on the roof like a pea-sized piece of like plutonium or something. What? Like with a... Oh no, it wasn't a roofing job. They like went and they had to scan everybody's roof with like the radiation sensors.
Okay.
And they found like a pea-sized piece of plutonium on somebody's roof.
Wow.
Because it was just like, as it was burning up, it was like shedding all of this nuclear waste on along this, you know, it's perfectly straight line it makes into the through the atmosphere before it hits. And that line, if you draw like a straight line kind of from Fort Rez to Litzelke to then out to the Thelon,
yeah,
is where it, all this shit fell out of the atmosphere. And then it made landfall right near the Thelon.
The Warden's Grove.
Yeah. It was found by some American people who were like overwintering out there.
Yeah, that's right. I did hear that. That's the part. There's this expedition happening at the time. Yeah. And I believe those guys started at the Pacific Ocean. They were crossing the continent, I'm pretty sure. And they're overwintering in the middle of Thelon at this cabin that was there.
Crazy. They had to get like...
The coincidence is remarkable. It's crazy. It's crazy.
They had to get airlifted out of there and flown, I want to say down to Florida, for all of these like pretty serious tests for exposure to radiation. Because when they found it, they like went and like dug it out of the... They could like see a piece of metal out in the Barrens, and they thought it was weird, so then they went over
to it.
And they
think it was like antlers or something?
Yeah, and then they dug it out of the snow and then realized what it was and then went and reported it. And then as soon as they reported it, they got like whisked out of there on some U.S. Air Force flight. Mm-hmm. I want to say to Florida to get all this like testing.
Imagine like we talk about with our friends about like being on a 42-day canoe trip and then coming back to society and having to deal with over... stimulation, sensory input, whatever it is, right? But these guys, like, they're overwintering in the Canadian Arctic and then just getting plucked out of there by helicopter, whatever it was. And then
it's crazy.
It would just rock your mind.
Yeah, it's a crazy story, man. And the podcast did such a good job. It's like one of those 6-part like mini series type things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish I knew the name, but I'll put it in the show notes. And It was like, you know, when you get into a podcast, and I think I listened to the whole thing in like one Saturday night.
Yeah. Okay.
I got so into it. It was like, I just couldn't stop. produced by a guy from like a Dene journalist from I think he's from Yellowknife for Hay River or something.
Okay. Cool.
So yeah, wild story.
Wow.
Did you go to Hornby's cabin?
We did not even look for it. No, did not. It
just wasn't on your radar.
Well, it was, and it was like, we kept finding, like, all along our route, we would find, like, these cabins. There's a bunch of them, like, Tundra Tom is a character from that way. He had a place on the west side of Whitefish Lake. We went and visited it. And, like, it was essentially, like, it just been abandoned, like, 20 years ago.
It's a bit gross.
It's just gross. Filled with garbage everywhere. And there's tarps and broken glass. And, you know, it's just kind of, like, ugly. And then you keep seeing these things every once in a while. And then, like, Warden's Grove we went and saw for the history of, like, the wardens that patrolled the Thelon River back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And same thing. There was a plaque there. It was cool. I saw Alex Hall's, like, name engraved on a log.
Cool.
Some cool history, but again, a lot of garbage there. And it's, by the time we got to Hornby's, we're like, I'm just tired of looking at human garbage. I did not come out here to look at other people's garbage.
No.
And from what I understand, most of the cabin's gone now. And from people taking souvenirs, it's pretty much all gone.
Really? That's sad.
Yeah. So we figured, like, and the other side of it too, we talked a lot about, was like, we used Chris McKenless from Into the Wild as an example, but like Hornby being a similar example from 100 years ago.
It's true. It's essentially
like earlier, not wanting to idolize people who have been reckless.
The worst part about him is he was reckless with the lives of the two kids.
Two other people. Yeah.
Like if you go out and kill yourself, you know, that's on you.
Yeah. But
those kids didn't know anything, man. They're from England.
No, exactly. So it's just like, I didn't want to like overly idolize like reckless person from the past by wanting to go see their cabin. And like, we were in the land, I could see the hills that they would walk on. We were there. I felt like I experienced whatever Hornby would have experienced, but like, I don't know, the guy's a bit of a nutcase.
He's total nutcase, man. That he had loose screws.
Yeah,
he just got lucky for a long time is my theory.
Yeah,
he got away with stuff because he was lucky.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm not giving him due credit, because like, he was probably skilled at survival, but
sure,
you know,
but
he would like go out and starve himself and somehow manage to eke through the winter, and then finally it got the best of him one year, you know.
Yeah,
so Anyway, it's crazy. Yeah. It's just a crazy story.
There's great stories there, and it's like I've read the stories, and yeah. But again, just to be careful of like.
Yeah, I think the fact that your trip went off without without any hitches, man, is like a testament to. It is. It's a testament.
We won't be celebrated once if I die from natural causes. My trips won't be celebrated no. because they just went smoothly.
No, but nobody it's a testament hurt. To like your ability to organize a big trip.
Thank you.
You know, like you know what you're capable of. There's a lot of people don't. They either over kind of anticipate what they're capable of or the opposite. You know what you can do in a 6-week period. And you picked right. a route that you know is like got water in the rivers and like yeah. you're going to be able to make it through. Like, you know, yeah. there's a lot of lessons learned on our barren land trip last right. year. Where like sure. we probably bit off more than we could chew. We were trying to get into areas that we didn't know anything about, but that
we also had some bad luck with the ice.
We had some bad luck, but also it's like, again, that's probably something that had we just like done a bit more.
Look at the back-to-back research. Years though, right? Like. If you had done your trip this year, the ice would have been up to a month earlier.
A month earlier, for sure.
Yeah.
A month earlier. But anyway,
yeah.
it's just a testament to good planning.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, this is my 9th trip, 30 days
yeah, long. Yeah, so you're a pro. You're a pro by now. When you guys were loading up at the house, I was surprised by how little stuff you had.
Yeah.
You were lean.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't know what it was. I mean, the boat had a fair bit of gear in it, but like you weren't overly loaded at all.
We were 2.5 carries each on the portages at the beginning.
Yeah, but quickly probably.
But they're heavy though. They're 80 to 100 pound loads.
But then quickly down to 2, probably.
Yeah, yeah. And the canoe was one of the loads. That was the half load each.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty efficient.
Yeah. And but we were low on luxuries. Like I brought a little trip guitar.
Yeah.
That's like
you didn't have all the filming gear we had.
We had no, we did not. No.
It's heavy stuff.
2 fishing rods. One of which we lost the reel. I don't know where. I have no idea.
Wasn't I trying to tell you to take an extra rod?
Yeah. Yeah. We lost the reel. It just disappeared. I couldn't even tell you where. Somewhere between Meridian Lake and the Snow Drift.
Okay.
Yeah.
Catch a lot of fish?
Yeah, a fair bit. Yeah. We were pretty busy, so we didn't fish as much as you might think.
But it made up a fair portion of your calories?
In the end, no.
No.
We ate fish 3 nights.
That's it?
That's it.
Oh, man. We ate fish like almost... every second night
okay
we were out there.
Yeah, I didn't do any sport fishing.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. It's I think it's as I gotten older, maybe it's from these types of trips, like the whole idea of sport fishing is
I don't like catch and release
lost to me these days.
I'm agree. I love fishing, but I want to eat the fish.
Like I'd be more happy putting on snorkel gear and flippers, like around here in Nova Scotia or wherever I am. I'd be more happy putting on some snorkel gear and swimming with the fish. I just want to see them.
Right.
Say, hey, what's up, buddy?
Yeah, and like all the catch and release fishermen will try to tell you that it doesn't hurt the fish, but I find that hard to believe.
Yeah.
Can't be fun, man. Yeah. Getting reeled in by...
You do like the barbless hook thing. There's ways around it.
There's ways around it. There is ways around it, but still.
I'm not like against it. It's just, I think as I've gotten older, if I'm not going to eat it, then I have no problem. If other people are catching, they're having fun, I'll watch, and it's all good.
For sure.
Yeah. But actually, one of the other problems was it's ridiculous to say, but like catching, there's only 2 of us. We don't need a 15 pound fish.
No.
So catching a fish that was small enough.
It's true. It's a fucking problem.
We needed like 3 to 5 pound fish.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to get a 3 to 5 pound lake trout, man. They're all here. They're all enormous.
It was. Yeah.
It's true. It's like only in the Barrens is that a problem, but it is.
It casts like 10 feet. And then if there was a pike, it would just take it out of the water. I'm like, I can't eat this much. Like, right. Same with the trout. And it's like, and the grayling were great.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all the right size.
They're all the right size.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great Slave, though, had some enormous grayling in it.
Oh, man. The fishing in that lake is unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
That lake is unbelievable altogether.
It's enormous.
It's remarkable.
People.
It's so cool.
People in the South don't understand how enormous it is.
No. And
it's cool because it's got so many arms and islands. It's
so diverse. There's so many different like landscapes in it.
Yeah.
Colors of the water and temperatures of the water. And there's like currents that move through it. And like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could spend a lot of time just exploring the lake. And
you really could.
I want to do that. Yeah. I would like to do that. I think one of my next trips. It's a good trip with. A little baby, you know.
Absolutely, because you can do your just go slow and
go slow. No portages. Just poke around.
Yeah.
And like tons of great fishing and the camping. You probably had great campsites.
Fantastic campsites.
It's all granite, like nice, you know, Canadian Shield.
Yeah. Big like gravel beaches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just watched Alone season 6.
Okay. Is that the one they did up
there? It's the one they did on Great Slave. And
Is it Kay? What's her name from Lure of the North? She was on that one.
No, she wasn't on that one.
No?
It was the one that
okay.
Jordan Jonas or whatever, he won.
Okay.
I don't think she was on that one.
Okay. Kai.
Right. A bunch of Canadians, though. There's like four, a number of Canadian women are on that show, but I don't think it was her. But it's all filmed on the shores of Great Slave Lake.
Okay.
Like this time of year, you know, like they go in August, yeah. I think late August. So like right. quickly winter sets in.
Right.
Yeah. It's a wild premise, that show, man.
Like, it is.
You know.
It is.
It's just crazy.
I get that all the time. Like, Dave, you should be on Alone. I'm like, no. I'm not.
There's a big difference between
like what we're doing out there. It's like I'm thriving out there. Yeah. I'm eating 4,000 calories a day. I'm sleeping on the Thermarest. Yeah. I have tons of clothing. I'm very comfortable.
Yeah.
99% of the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not interested in starving. I use a lighter to light every single fire I had. I use a lighter. Yeah.
I'm not interested in starving for like 76 days. The winter did. It's a long time, man. He shot a moose, though.
What?
Yeah, he shot a moose. And that's the key. Like, if you can shoot a big animal, then you're, like, fed for a while.
Well, it's the psychological game. Like, any of these things. Similar to our trips, too. It's not the physicality of it. It's the psychology of it. But for them, not knowing how many people are left.
Because you
just don't know.
It's a game, man. That's the weirdest part. It's a fucking game. You have no idea. You have no idea if there's 10 other people still going or you're the last one. Or I guess when you're the last one, then they pull you out. But if there's two people going.
If there's two people, you don't know.
No.
That's it.
No. Noah told me that they reached out to him.
Oh, yeah?
And they asked him if he wanted to audition.
Nice.
So
cool.
I don't know if he has any... I don't think he's interested. But
it's a lot of quid. It's a lot of quid for winning.
Maybe you'll get a call here any day, Dave.
Yeah. Well, that's what Jim and Ted Baird used to launch their social
media. That's true, and it's been good for them, man. It's been good for them. You know, they won, didn't they?
They did.
Season one, maybe. The very beginning.
Could have been, yeah.
I think they won the first one.
Okay.
That's when they... I think they camped together. Like the premise of that one was like you went out with a pair.
They dropped them in separate places, and one person had to go find the other person.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a wild show. They just filmed another season in the NWT.
Okay.
But it was all British. It was like Alone UK. Okay. A bunch of British people.
Right.
So I don't know if the fires had an impact on that or not.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, it's going to be...
I like being comfortable as possible out there.
Yeah.
Because you said we didn't bring much, but we had the luxuries. Like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You had a bottle of whiskey?
Yep. I brought about 52 ounces. So like the Mickey's, like the 13 ounce Mickey's. I brought three whiskey, one Southern Comfort.
Did you do the Frank Wolf thing and leave a bottle with a note in it somewhere on the...
I did not. No. You did not. And they're all plastic bottles. And
yeah, you don't want to do that.
I burned them up as I went. Yeah.
You're right.
Made it last most of the trip though. And it's nice to have.
Such a nice treat.
Yeah.
Such a nice treat. You did a trip with Frank, didn't you?
I did a trip with Frank 2 years ago.
Cool.
Yeah, kind of like COVID was all going down.
Did you leave a bottle of whiskey on that trip?
There is a bottle of whiskey hidden.
With a note in it?
With a note in it.
Cool.
I don't know exactly where it is. He didn't tell me. But I know it's on the Clearwater River in Alberta. Is that the name of it? Clearwater? Yeah. It runs into Fort McMurray. It's on the Clearwater at the bottom of the... Skull Rapids, somewhere in there.
Cool.
Yeah.
And what was the route on that trip?
It was a loop trip. So this is 2021, and the territories were all still locked down. We couldn't get in there.
Right.
And so Frank drew up a route that started and ended in Fort McMurray.
Okay.
So we went down the Athabasca, which is north, into Lake Athabasca. and then went east across the whole length of Lake
Assateague. Across the southern shore?
The southern shore, right through the dunes.
Through the dunes. I've always wanted to go there.
It's a really cool spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They look cool.
Yeah. And then through Fond du Lac, Stony Rapids, and Black Lake up the Fond du Lac River.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then across Black Lake and up the Cree River to Cree Lake. And then we did a bunch of, like, as Frank would call it, mystery moves. So basically, he looks at the topo map and says, okay, this makes sense. We could probably get through here. Did that and crossed like a height of land that got us back into the Clearwater system and then back down to Fort Mac.
Cool.
Yeah.
Big loop into Saskatchewan?
Big loop into Saskatchewan, yeah.
So is it like Muskeggy and Buggy or what's the...
No, it's like Jackpine Forest.
Jackpine Forest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Again, super hot and dry, low on the bugs, tons of forest fires.
Yeah, so yeah, real tinder dry up there, wasn't it?
Tinder dry. Crazy dry.
Yeah. It's amazing. Man, it's amazing how dry the north is this year. Like, it's no wonder it's all burning up.
Seriously, yeah.
We didn't get any rain from like when it probably the second week of May. It like summer just arrived. It went from being April was cool, you know, it's like April in the north, it's still winter. You know, skiing on the lake. So then it just switched and it went to the 20s probably in the second week of May. And it was just 20 and sunny every day. Still in the 20s and sunny. In other words, we're in the last day of August today.
Yeah.
It's been like months and months and months of no rain. Like I can count on one hand how many days of rain there was.
Right. Yeah.
It's insane. The whole place is so dry and you get any fire and you can't, like, this is what's happening. They can't put them out. They will not go out. All you can do is try to steer them and contain them and not have the towns burned down.
Right.
And it's a disaster. There's, I think, currently 70% of the NWT's residents are under an evacuation order. And like that's not just like one town. That's like Yellowknife, Hay River, Fort Smith, Jean Marie River, I think just went back, but they were evacuated.
Yeah.
There's like four or five communities,
right.
All of them several like, hundred kilometers away from each like other.
Enterprise is essentially gone.
And Enterprise is gone.
Ugh.
It's not like these communities are all just in the same place. They're like, Fort Smith is like an 8-hour drive from Yellowknife and Hay River is a 5-hour drive. And they're all evacuated because they're all burning down. Like the whole, it's fucked.
What complicates it too is the sheer distance. Yeah. That in order to evacuate from somewhere, you have to drive.
1,600 kilometers basically to Edmonton. Yeah. Yeah, it's a disaster. There's going to be, you know, I think a lot of thinking that's going to happen this winter. I'm like, what is the long-term strategy here? Because,
yeah, and also tough for, like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but a town like Yellowknife, it's not, like, a bustling urban metropolis. Like,
no, it's like...
You have the mines and stuff, but, like, if Yellowknife were to burn down, would they would rebuild it, I'm sure. The locals would, but, like, it's not tons of money there.
No, but they'd rebuild it. It's, like...
It's the end of the road.
It's the regional hub.
Yeah.
I don't think it would burn, the whole city would burn down. Like, I can't see that happening, but like I was worried that certain neighborhoods were going to burn down
just a
couple weeks ago when the fire looked like it was going to roll into town. I thought that was certainly a possibility. I was like, there's going to be people who are going to lose their homes, but I didn't think the whole city was going to burn down.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, there's just like lots of like concrete in the downtown. And,
sure.
You know, that certain parts of the town are like, you know, down kind of well protected by the lake.
Yeah. And
so, yeah, I like was never worried that like there wouldn't be a town, but I was worried that there might not be like certain parts of town. And actually, you know, where the fire was projected to come into town was the fuel depot.
Come on.
Yeah. They have like these huge fuel silos where it's all the fuel for like the airport uses a lot of fuel because all the flights to Nunavut and the remote NWT communities leave out of Yellowknife and all those planes need fuel. So there's like a huge fuel depot, I think, for the airport, but also just for heating oil and gasoline and whatever else they need. And the mines. I think the mines stage all their fuel delivery out of Yellowknife.
Okay.
So there's like, they're enormous. They're like maybe 100 meters wide, 80 feet tall, these like huge fuel silos, and the fire was going to plow right. It was the first thing that the fire was going to hit because they're way out on the edge of town,
right,
the west end of town where the fire was coming into. So like
that'd be a problem.
That'd be a problem. So you can't let that happen. So there was a lot of effort to, you know, make a huge fire break around those and set up sprinklers. But they set up like, I think, I can't remember how many hundreds of, I want to say kilometers, but that might be an exaggeration. But the amount of water line that got set up in like days.
Okay.
They've just made a whole perimeter around the city that's like just pouring water onto the forest. And
yeah,
you know, it's crazy.
It's crazy. I was actually, when, remember the Fort McMurray fire in 2016?
Yeah.
I was living in Fort Chip.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
I didn't know you lived up there.
I was teaching up there.
Oh, cool.
When that fire happened.
Fuck.
There's a flying community.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's maybe 300-400 kilometers north of Fort Mac. But like, our world filled with smoke. There's like ash falling from the sky.
Yeah.
Town doubled in size overnight with all the evacuees coming.
They were evacuating people north to Chip.
To Chip. Well, a lot of locals from like Fort McKay and stuff were coming home just for somewhere to go.
Were people zipping down the Athabasca River?
That too. But it was early in the season. It was like Easter, April.
Yeah,
so there was still ice on Lake Athabasca.
Super early. Right.
And the Northern Star ran out of food and the school got closed and turned into an evacuation center.
Right.
We were just volunteering, essentially, helping the best we could. But then it was like, then the reality started to sit in for all of us. We were like, oh man, what if the fire lights here? Like, there's literally nowhere for us to go.
No, not there. I guess the lake.
That's where I'm going with this. Is Athabasca still had ice on it, and if you had a boat, yeah, you could go out into the lake. But like, would Great Slave Lake be a viable option if you had a boat? Like,
I think so.
Yeah,
I think like it's the ultimate safe haven. If the fire burns from the west, it will push everyone towards the lake, and then it's like if you're equipped, it's a great option, right? Yeah. Like. I wasn't there, but we have neighbors who didn't leave town, contrary to the evacuation order, who just had, presumably the boat is still loaded with two or 3 weeks of food and all the camping gear.
Ready to go.
And like, I think if you have that at your disposal, staying is a good option. Cause like, I knew I wouldn't die
because
I have all the equipment,
right.
But there's a lot of people who don't have 2 weeks of food just at have them at any given time and don't have tents and sleeping bag and all the stove and all the gear, you know? And I think they evacuated to be safe and to like, you know, knowing that not everyone is as well prepared as people like me and some of my friends. But I feel like a lot of our friends stayed. I would have been inclined to stay, I think, just because, you know, I'm confident I wouldn't die. Like I can just like get out onto the lake. And then once you're on the lake, you can, you know, easily get 50 or 80 kilometers from town and be safe on an island somewhere.
Yeah.
You might have to wait a while. But the city, like, you know, when they did the evacuation, all those people who were thinking the same thing as me and thinking of that were that option was given no real thought, or like it wasn't respected as a viable option by the city. They were discouraging people from doing that.
Right.
And I get it, like people might not, it might be a while. You'd have to be prepared to camp out on an island for like could be several weeks before the city's they're going to let people back into the city, you know?
Yeah.
And if you have a medical, you know, if you're out on an island and then you have like a medical condition,
right,
then no one's coming to get you.
No.
Like I think I would be prepared to like take those risks, but I get that other people like maybe are not prepared to take those risks.
Yeah.
So the easiest thing to do is just get everyone out of town, which is what they did.
Right.
But at huge expense, $100 million so far is what the NWT has spent on wildfires this year.
Wow.
And that doesn't count for,
lost income.
Lost income, you know, like people like the fishing lodges or Jack Pine or all these people who have had to shut their businesses, you know, or the restaurants. Anyway, you know, it's like COVID. It's unfortunate. It's so unfortunate because it's like 2 years of COVID. All these businesses just got through what were really tough years in the NWT because the border was shut, which you know, because you couldn't do your trip.
That's right.
And like tourism's a big thing for all of the services, you know, like the restaurants and the breweries and, you know, they all rely on tourists really. And there's a whole tourism infrastructure, like business infrastructure there. There's like, you know, a whole bunch of tour operators and fishing lodges and stuff. And now, you know, two tough years. They get 1 year last year, which was like kind of back to normal, but not quite.
Not quite.
And then now they have this, and you know, And that was on the 19th. It was like we're coming up on 2 weeks. And no, they're still, I don't know when we're going to go home. No one's told us. There's no word on when we're going to be able to go home. Yeah. The fire's still burning.
Yeah, right.
You know,
it's like the road.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy. We're just grateful we're in Nova Scotia and not in like a motel in Grand Prairie with like a baby and a cat, man. That would be awful. You know, so yeah, it's not a good situation. And like, you know, it's not like there's not going to be fires next year. It's just the same type of thing is going to happen year after year, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know what to. It's almost like if you know, like it has kind of always been off everyone's radar doing trips up there, but I think going forward, it's going to be like something you got to think about. You need like we have several friends who had trips planned. Okay. We had friends who were going to paddle the, from Great Bear Lake down the Great Bear River.
Oh yeah.
And they had to cancel that trip
because
of fire in the area and do go to plan B. And they went and did something on Great Slave. But like, it's like kind of like all these people who do plan these like once in a lifetime trips up there are going to need to have plan Bs.
Contingency plan.
What are you going to do if there's a huge fire in your area? You know, probably not go on a trip there.
Probably not.
No. You guys saw fire on your trip?
We did. Yeah, we saw fires. Yeah.
What's that like? I've never been up close to one, man.
We were never really that close. I couldn't see flames.
Right.
Just tons of smoke.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen smoke from, you can see tell there's a fire burning off from like the horizon somewhere, but I've never been up close to one.
Yeah. No, neither did I, but I've read the stories of like, have you read the Hap Wilson story on the Seal River, North Seal River? They had a fire come in on them. It was on both sides of the river and they had to like get into the water beside their canoe and
tread water,
float through it.
Float
through it. Yeah. And he's got like images, maybe some video too of them camped out at night, like on a tiny little lake with the fire on the other side of the lake. They're kind of like trapped and they had to like
crazy
just monitor through the night and then like get into the water with their boats.
Man, they move fast. Like the fire that almost burnt down Hay River in one day moved 50 or 60 kilometers, I think.
That's a long ways.
And you're getting spot fires. It was a really windy day. Jumping way ahead, like kilometers ahead of the head of the fire.
Yeah.
It's like you can't control that, man. You know?
It's an old trapper's story too. I don't know. I don't know the source at all of this. I don't remember it. Probably just a story an old timer told me. But like, if there was a forest fire being in an area, and like an old trapper going down to like a pond, and like getting into the pond and sinking his canoe, just I guess the thing you do back in the day, and then being in the middle of the pond while the fire comes in and all the animals from the forest coming into the pond with him. So he's like chilling with the bear and the deer and the moose and the raccoons and the otters and everyone's just chilling in the pond all together waiting for the fire to like put itself out or move on.
Wow. I mean, that would, I can, presumably that would happen.
Yeah. Presumably that could happen.
Do you remember there's like a Canadian, what were those history, like moments in Canadian history? Those little ads on TV.
Oh yeah.
There's one where the family, they get into the lake. Do you remember they got, it's like, I think it's, I want to say in the prairies or in Quebec or something. Yeah. It's one of the, like, it's one of those moments in Canadian
history. Heritage moments.
Canadian heritage moments.
Yeah.
Crazy. Like if you're having to get into the lake, that's a serious situation.
And we were seeing tundra fires this summer too, which I guess is, I'd never considered. I considered if you're above the tree line, I mean, there's no issue with a fire, but like we saw huge clouds of smoke coming up off of the barren lands.
Right. Burning moss.
Yeah. And we could see places where the moss had been burned right down to the shoreline.
Wow.
Yeah. So I suppose like lightning could strike or sphagnum.
Yeah. It gets dry. It gets really dry and crunchy.
Yeah. And then it could burn underground for.
That's what they're saying.
For months, it could smolder away all winter or something. And they're saying
some of these fires in the Northwest Territories could very well burn all winter.
Yeah.
The root systems of the trees burn away all winter.
And the snow would insulate it.
Yeah.
It would just burn underground, and then next spring, a big wind come up.
It's crazy. It's like, I don't know. don't know. It doesn't give you much
hope. It's always
hope,
been
man.
A reality for canoe trippers in the north, though.
It's true,
it's
but it's
something you think about a lot.
It's never crossed my mind, man. Like,
yeah.
But I think going forward, people are going to have to think about it.
Yeah.
You know, and just what a shit show. Like, I was talking to Dan about having to get everybody off the land. You know, he had all these people. He had people scattered all over the north on trips.
Yeah,
and
suddenly
he's got to get them out.
There would have been quite a few people. And just like, I mean, that's an outfitter. And then there's a lot of summer camps that run trips up there. And people would have been out on the land when the evacuation order dropped.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What do we do? The plan was to go back to Yellowknife. Like, what do we do? Like,
we have friends who were just in the situation and they just stayed out. They knew they had lots of food. And
yeah.
Just kept going. I mean, you're safe, you know? You're safe. And
yeah.
Yellowknife's not safe.
That's
why,
right.
Why go back there? The only problem is you get into a situation where there's like now no one in Yellowknife to come get you.
Right.
You know, if you did have an issue, it's a long way for help, you know?
Right.
They were way down by the East Arm there. So, like, there's help in Litzelkay. They were down by Reliance.
Okay.
There is help. Like, they could get airlifted to somewhere. But, like, Fort Smith is evacuated.
Yeah.
Hay River's, like, all of the three nearest communities are all evacuated.
All in the lake, too.
All in the lake.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, what a decision, eh? Like... they got an in-reach message like Yellowknife's been evacuated. Like, what are you gonna do?
Right.
It's a little bit of pondering you'd have to do that evening about
what
the plans are.
Serious.
Yeah, but yeah, I guess you guys found out super late. It was you were in the final day or two.
We were in Baker Lake when we started getting all these messages from people. Yeah.
Down here who didn't know the difference between Baker Lake and Yellowknife.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, but it delayed your trip out, eh?
It did, yeah. All of our pilots all got pulled, so all of our flights got canceled.
Right.
Because the Calm Airlines is a subsidiary of Air Canada.
Right.
And I guess...
They needed all those pilots flying to Yellowknife.
They flew out, man.
The whole city got... Not everyone flowing, because a lot of people drove, but I think they flew out like 10,000 people in 24 hours almost.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, they had a list, and you didn't have to book a flight or anything. You just walk up to the airport
and
get on a plane. And there was planes coming in
into
the airport every 30 or 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Just put...
Load them up,
send them out. And you would just get on a plane, and you didn't even know where you were going. Like, they would... You had a loose idea. You're like, I'm either going to Winnipeg or Calgary or Edmonton.
Yeah.
I think those were the three. And you land, and basically they, like, try to... Like, there was some organization, but hardly any. Like, they'd get you to a hotel, and then
you
kind of have to figure it out from there. And these people are still there.
Right.
Like, weeks later. It's awful. It's
too bad. It's awful.
Yeah. You know, so, yeah, we're grateful to be here. And, as I say, not in a motel in Grand Prairie or something.
Seriously.
No, thanks.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, just the disruption to the city, man. A lot of people, like you know, they seem like small things, but... lost their gardens, lost their...
Well, in places like too, and you have all these like outfitters or seasonal dependent businesses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's gonna be tough for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big industry. Fishing and canoe tourism and you know, hunting outfitters. Yeah. They're all hooped. So we'll see. But yeah. Should we talk about anything else?
Yeah, it's been good. I think we've covered a lot of things.
How can people... We didn't get into Night of Adventure, but maybe a quick plug for Night of Adventure.
I also got a podcast out there called the Night of Adventure Podcast. It's available on all the streaming, wherever you get your podcast. It's out there. It's very similar to Kyle's, but it has more of a broad focus on other badass adventures like ultra runners and mountain climbers. And
generally
whoever I can find.
And... The Night of Adventure speaker series is cool too.
Right. And the Night of Adventure speaker series. Yeah.
Maybe a quick description,
which is, exploring the human spirit through storytelling.
Yeah.
Inspirational speaker series, just finding local people who've done crazy badass things and, giving them an opportunity to share their story through picture and video, in front of their friends and family, strangers alike. It's nothing that goes better storytelling than drinking beer.
That's true.
Yeah.
They're often at a brewery, aren't they?
I've been doing it down here in Nova Scotia for about 10 years now, and And Kyle here has franchised it out to Yellowknife. I think you've done two events up there now.
Two, yeah. I'll have another one in the fall.
Yep.
And you've just, how much money have you distributed now over the years?
I've given away almost 10 grand.
That's awesome.
About $10,000.
That's awesome.
We started the Night of Adventure grant. It's a way to give back to our community. And we take the ticket sales and pool it all up and then open up an application system at the end of the season, usually about April.
Yeah.
And it's open to anybody who can apply. And I sit down with my friends, we drink some beer, and we pick out the winners, and we just give them cash. To go,
the,
go ahead.
The motto, it's the easiest grant you'll ever apply for.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We got a guy that actually this weekend, he's paddling across Nova Scotia. So from a little town called Hansport, and he's going to paddle across the province and go to work on Tuesday. So he's planning to paddle right to work on Spring Garden Road, downtown Halifax on Tuesday.
That's awesome.
Zach Dixon, he's on Instagram. You probably follow along. He'll be done by the time you listen to this. But we just gave him $500 cash, and it'll cover his food, cover
gas,
a lot of
gas
stuff
up to Hansport.
His gas, and, yeah.
It's a great thing, man.
Yeah.
So keep it going.
And then you gave out some cash to somebody.
Yeah,
this
year. Yeah. We only had two events, so we gave up $500.
It's plenty.
A guy who will hopefully be on the show to tell us all about it. Cycled the Cannell Trail.
I heard about this guy, actually. He was the bike mechanic at Outlander, wasn't he?
Overlander, yeah. Yeah, Dave.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
he's
right.
Currently holed up in Whitehorse.
Is he?
Because of the fire, yeah.
That's a good place to be.
So yeah, we gave him $500. This year, I only had two events. This year, I want to have more and hopefully give out $1,000.
Cool.
So yeah, it's cool.
Yeah.
I owe it all to you, man.
It's just a great way to build community and give back and hear some stories and make some friends.
It's been fun. We've been holding them at a little restaurant that only seats like 30 people, but it's been real intimate. We've had some cool speakers.
So what is it all about? Because people rarely get an opportunity to tell their story.
Yeah.
Like, you get back from these big trips and people will ask you, how was the trip? And they either want to hear, it was great, thanks for asking, and most people are happy with that. But some people really want to hear the story, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the feedback has been awesome. People have been really enjoying it.
Nice. Good.
It's kind of, it's like, how I describe it is it's like the Banff Mountain Film Festival, but without the films and actual people.
No, exactly. It's the Banff Mountain Film Festival meets TED Talks.
Yeah.
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 But not as structured.
Yeah. No.
And more off the cuff.
Off the cuff when you drink beer at Q&A. It's just a good time. It's a good time. Thanks for coming on the show, Dave.
Thank you, Carl.
It's a pleasure, man.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
Yeah. Keep me posted on your travels.
Absolutely.